Right now, most churches are planning their budgets for 2009. Your church can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 on the sponsors page at issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. Download the flyer and present it to your congregation today. Welcome back to Issues Etc. It's Monday, October the 20th. We continue our series with Pastor Paul McCain. We're in part four of a seven-part weekly series with him on the Lutheran Confessions. These formative documents, they're really not just descriptive, but definitive documents from the 16th century Reformation, written by the Lutheran reformers, various people, Luther and Melanchthon and others, some of them even written by committees of sorts. And they, by the time they're all finished, they get to the seventh and final document, really do define, not only then but now, what it means to be a theological descendant of that Reformation in the 16th century. They are as relevant today, even though we speak a different language and live some centuries beyond them, they're as relevant today, not only for Lutherans, but for all who would consider themselves sons and daughters of the Reformation, as they were when they were penned. Today we're going to talk about the power and primacy of the Pope, the fourth document in the Lutheran Confessions. You can join us, 1-877-623-MY-IE, or talk back at issuesetc.org. Pastor Paul McCain is publisher and executive director of the editorial department for Concordia Publishing House based in St. Louis, general editor of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions. Paul, welcome back.
Great to be back again, Todd.
Golly, you know, Lutherans and then I guess you could say Protestants in general, if most of them, if they think they know something, one thing about the 16th century Reformation, it's this. It was an all-out rejection of the Pope and his entire organization. It was, in essence, a rebellion against the papacy. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would use the title of the document that we're going to talk about today to reject that assertion. I would say this. The Reformation was all about reclaiming the power and primacy of the gospel in the church. Hence, they had to reject the alleged power and primacy of the Pope.
Did they understand initially, I'm thinking here about Luther and Melanchthon and the other principles, that there was it was really going to come down to this, either uphold the power and primacy of the gospel itself or uphold the power and primacy of the papacy?
Luther came to this realization earlier than Melanchthon did. I believe that at the time of the Diet of Augsburg in 1530, Luther was pretty much convinced that the Pope would have to be rejected in order for the gospel to be supreme in the church. But when we get to this document in 1537, it had become painfully obvious that the Pope and the way it was operating at the time of the Reformation simply had to be rejected because it was such an obstacle to the glory and merit of Christ.
Okay, the big question that people often ask up front, even before they go into the details of what the reformers were saying about the office of the papacy is, well, is it still relevant today? Has the papacy changed enough that if Luther and the other reformers were penning the document, they wouldn't have been as tough on the office of the papacy as they were then? How would you respond?
They may not have used the same kind of language, because we have to keep in mind the language of the 16th century was just more harsh all the way around. So we just have to set that concern aside for the moment. But there's no question whatsoever that even to this day, they would be conscience-bound to identify the papacy as Antichrist, because we are obligated by Scripture to historically identify who the Antichrist is and what it is. And to the extent the papacy continues to claim as official dogma the canons and decrees of the Council of Trent, which expressly continue to reject and condemn, to damn, actually, for instance, the doctrine that justifying faith is nothing else than trust in divine mercy, which remits sins for Christ's sake, to that extent, the papacy must be identified as the Antichrist to this day.
Okay, does the document itself, the power and primacy of the Pope, distinguish between the man who holds the office and the office itself?
Yes, because it's very clear in defining the office of the papacy, the office is said to be Peter in the church today. This office is held by a sequence of individual Christians. We can't judge people's hearts. This is the mystery of Antichrist and evil, that the man who holds the office may well himself be a Christian. We can't judge hearts. We don't presume to judge any person's heart. We distinguish, therefore, between the office per se and the man holding that office. But the office of Pope, and hence we say the Pope, is the true Antichrist.
Now, you mentioned the Council of Trent, which came years after this document was written,
right,
where it is explicit and canonized, literally put down in black and white for the entire church, the Roman church, to be bound to. A rejection of the doctrine of justification by grace through faith for Christ's sake alone. But at this point in history, when they're writing this document, were those kind of statements coming out of the papacy?
Yes, already we see in the confutation to the Augsburg Confession, for example, a clear rejection of the heart of the Lutheran assertion about the gospel. So these claims were already being made, and this is why Melanchthon, who wrote this document, is so careful to walk through the scripture passages that they base the office of the papacy on and carefully refute them point by point by point. And in this sense, the power and primacy of the Pope is one of the most well-written, concise, clear documents in the entire Book of Concord.
What was the essential problem with the papacy as far as Melanchthon was concerned?
The essential problem is that the Pope claims for himself that he is supreme above all bishops and pastors by divine right. That happens to be the first sentence in the power and primacy of the Pope. And then, by divine right, so claimed, he has both swords, that is, the authority to enthrone and depose kings, regulate secular dominions and such. Now, interestingly enough, at this point in our history, today, the Pope no longer makes such grand claims for secular authority. In fact, in my copy of the Book of Concord, I'm looking here where, paragraph 51, Melanchthon says, the Pope exercises a twofold tyranny. A, he defends his errors by force and by murder, and I wrote in the column today, no. But B, he forbids judicial examinations. Today, yes. Nobody can overrule or judge the Pope. And that continues to be true to today. The Pope is over all councils. He can even reverse conciliar decisions if he desires to.
Now, we also need to point out that at this time, it was not officially a promulgated teaching of the Roman Church that the Pope was infallible when he speaks ex cathedra, was it?
let me say this. Cathedra statement about the ex cathedra authority of the Pope had not yet been made, but clearly the Pope was claiming and grabbing for this kind of authority and power. And so today I'm looking, for instance, at the Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraphs 880 through 887 and following. Very clearly, the Catholic Church, since the time of Trent, just claims that the Pope is the ultimate authority and the true head in the church, through whom all authority in the church flows.
What was the Catholic argument at the time that would have been used? I don't know if there was a response, but what was the Catholic argument that would have been used to say, no, the Pope does possess this kind of authority, both temporal and spiritual, and he is in fact the successor of Peter by Christ's own direct command?
Well, some of this authority was based on some faulty historical documentation, which was exposed to be false, that the Pope had been given both the sword of authority in the church and the sword of authority in the state, and that was refuted. But Rome, when pressed to give scriptural arguments for the authority of the Pope, relied on their interpretation of Matthew 16, where Christ says to Peter, I say to you, you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. And then, interestingly enough, also John 21, where he says, to Peter, feed my sheep. Those were two key proof texts for them for asserting papal authority.
Okay, if it didn't mean what the Roman Church was saying it meant, briefly, with only about a minute and a half before our break, What did those two passages really intend to teach?
All you have to do is go to the power and primacy of the Pope, look at paragraph 23. Philip says it very beautifully. Peter is the representative of the entire assembly of apostles, as appears from the text itself. Christ does not ask Peter alone when he says, "Who do you say that I am?" So, in other words, we're refuting the claim that Peter alone is the one to whom says Christ says, "I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven."
And then the John 20 passage, the I guess it falls in line there pretty soon.
Exactly. John, let's go to John 20:23. Whatsoever you plural bind is bound. Whatever you plural forgive is forgiven. So Melanchthon concludes, these words show that the keys are given to all the apostles alike and that all the apostles are sent forth alike.
With only 30 seconds, Paul, is there any kind of escape hatch in this document, the power and primacy of the Pope, whereby the reformers said, look, if the Pope would just give on this, that, and the other subjects, then we got no problem with him wearing his pointy hat and doing all the other things he's been doing around here?
Well, actually, that escape hatch is added by Melanchthon himself at the end of the small called articles, where he signs with the condition that if the Pope were to allow the gospel, we would be willing to accept his authority in church matters. But this document is very pointed, and there's not much wiggle room. In fact, Melanchthon himself years later said to a friend, "I wrote this treatise somewhat more sharply than I wanted to." Well, thank God he did.
We're talking with Pastor Paul McCain, publisher and executive director of the editorial department for Concordia Publishing House based in St. Louis. He's general editor of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions, part four of our seven-part weekly series with him on the Lutheran Confessions, the treatise on the power and primacy of the Pope. Now, someone listening to this point is going to say, well, this is all very interesting historically, and yes, it may still be true today of the office of the papacy, but what does it matter, really? Is this just a debate over who's who and who sits at the top of the heap when it comes to the church? What was really at stake for the Lutheran reformers when they rejected the claimed power and primacy of the papal office? We'll answer that question after this.
We call devotional time in the Schwarz household Jesus time. We use a hymnal, a Bible, the catechism, and a book of prayers. I've always wanted a devotional book with all of these resources. Well, it's coming this fall. It's called Treasury of Daily Prayer. Find out about it on our homepage, issuesetc.org, or by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. A family-friendly devotional resource, Treasury of Daily Prayer.
Will your church be one of the Issues Etc. 300? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. We're looking for 300 congregations to pledge $1,000 to Issues Etc. in their budgets. To find out more about the Issues Etc. 300, click the Sponsors section of our website, issuesetc.org. You'll even find a one-page informational flyer. Please consider including Issues Etc. in your church's mission or advertising budget. The Issues Etc. 300.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you been hungering for a richer life of prayer and meditation on God's Word? Well, Concordia Publishing House is pleased to bring you Treasury of Daily Prayer. It's coming in October. To experience Treasury of Daily Prayer, click the book cover on our homepage, issuesetc.org, or you can order an advance copy of Treasury of Daily Prayer by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, Treasury of Daily Prayer.
Would you like to post your favorite Issues Etc. audio segments on your website or blog? Well, we've made it easy for you. Just go to the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, click the embed green logo, and copy and paste the embed code on your website or blog. It's just like posting a YouTube video. Embed Issues Etc. audio on your website or blog today. We love our on-demand listeners. Old theology, new technology. Issuesetc.org.
I'm Todd Wilkin. Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about the power and primacy of the Pope, part 4 of our 7-part weekly series with Pastor Paul McCain on the Lutheran Confessions. It's Monday, October the 20th. Our in-studio phone number, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943, or email us, our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. Calling from St. Louis, here's Ann. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I have always been confused about the interpretation of that verse, "Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church." I mean, I grew up Catholic, and of course the emphasis was on Peter. How can that be misinterpreted if they go back to the original languages it was written in?
That's a great question, Ann. Thank you. Paul?
Well, I think that's a problem. They were overlooking, frankly, intentionally, the fact that the Greek is very clear that Peter's name is Petros, and when Christ uses the word rock, which is a form of the word Petros, it is Petra. But the point really is theological. They assume Christ was building a church on a man, when the power and primacy of the Pope says the church has not been built upon the authority of a man, rather it has been built upon the ministry of the confession Peter made when he proclaims Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And so Christ is addressing Peter as a minister of the church, that is, on this rock his ministry. And as Jesus said, if you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. So, Todd, you were asking before the break, why is this so important? Because this is a struggle for the ultimate source of authority in the church. Is it on the authority of a man, no matter how pious, devout, inspired, or whatnot, or is it the gospel and the word of Christ alone? And definitely the scriptures teach it is the word, the ministry of the confession of that word. On this rock is the word of Christ.
When the confessors made the case, the biblical case, and they do very carefully, that the papacy is a kind of, first caliber example of the spirit of Antichrist. When they did this, how did they do it, and did they mean to say, well, it's only the papacy that's the Antichrist, you need look no further?
No. The spirit of Antichrist is alive and well in various forms and movements and persons throughout the church's history. I mean, the New Testament predicts that the church throughout its history will witness many Antichrists. You know, Christ says this in Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, 1 John 2, and so forth. All false teachers who teach against Christ's word are opponents of Christ, and insofar as they do, they are Antichrist. However, the scriptures teach that there is one climactic Antichrist, Daniel 7, 2 Thessalonians 2, 1 John 2, Revelation 17 to 18. And it's this identity of the Antichrist that we affirm, and this is why we affirm the Lutheran Confession's identification of the Antichrist with the office of the papacy, whose claims about itself correspond to the scriptural marks listed above. And in all these Bible verses, the Pope puts himself in the seat of God, makes binding commandments. The scriptures say this figure will come who will even forbid marriage and so forth. And this fits the marks of the Antichrist. The papacy does perfectly.
This doesn't make for good PR. When I was doing this radio program in its previous incarnation, nothing got people at the synodical headquarters twittering and nervous as when we talked about the simple teaching of the Lutheran Confessions, by the way, that the office of the papacy is the Antichrist. Nothing got them more nervous. It was terrible PR.
Well, that's too bad, because everything I've been saying I've been reading right off of a public FAQ page on the LCMS.org website. So it's out there for the world to read. It may not make for popular listening in the St. Louis area, which is a strong Roman Catholic area. But now, Todd, let me say something very clearly, and I know you will agree with me 1,000%. We are not saying that Roman Catholics are not Christians. First of all, we can't judge people's hearts. Secondly, as good Lutherans, we both know that Martin Luther and all the Reformers clearly understood that in the Roman Church, in spite of the errors, the gospel was read and heard, and therefore the Holy Spirit was doing his work. They have the true sacrament of the altar. They have the body and blood of Christ. So this is why, for Lutherans, while we must make these assertions, it is so painful, because we are so close to the Roman Church in many ways. For years I've said that what is uniquely Roman in the Roman Catholic Church is not Catholic, necessarily. and what is truly Catholic is definitely by no means specifically Roman. So we share so many things in common with the Church of Rome, and we do believe that there are many dear Christian believers in the Roman Catholic Church, and in no way, shape, or form are we implying or asserting that all Roman Catholics are not Christians.
Is it true in your estimation, your reading of the Lutheran Confessions, not just this document, but the whole broad sweep of them, that the Reformers understood themselves to be Catholic small c, we would say it that way nowadays, of course, but truly that is people of the faith that has always at every place to every Christian been taught and believed, and that they're we would use the term movement, but they certainly would have rejected something like that. Their efforts on the part of the gospel was nothing more than a confession from within this Catholic Church. Am I reading too much back into my hopes and aspirations of what the Reformers were trying to do there?
No, and I suppose you want me to elaborate.
I would love for you to elaborate.
Jeff told me to do that to you sometime. Just answer with one word, no. Absolutely not. And as we began this series, the Book of Concord is filled with comments to this very effect, that we are not revolting. We are crying out for reform precisely so that the true teaching of Christ and his word can come through clearly. So many times throughout the Augsburg Confession, for instance, Melanchthon makes the point. The church has always teach this. We with the church of all times and in all places teach this and assert this. This is what we believe, teach, confess. They put the blame, if you will, for the fracture, for the split, directly where it belongs, on the Roman bishops who prevented the preaching of the pure gospel of Jesus Christ. But yeah, absolutely right. Some people say Lutherans could be referred to as evangelical Catholics. That's an interesting way of putting it, that we are all about the gospel of Jesus Christ, as that gospel has been believed, taught, and confessed since the earliest days of the apostles.
Is it as simple that for these Reformers that it was really just about the preaching of the gospel purely, the administration of the sacraments purely, without the imposition of abuses and errors in the Roman Church?
Yes. In fact, as you ask me that question, I'm just looking at the section in The Power and Primacy of the Pope called The Marks of the Antichrist. And as Melanchthon lists all the things the Pope has done, for instance, he takes for himself the right to change Christ's doctrine. He takes to himself power not only of binding and loosing in this life, but jurisdiction over souls in the next life. What I'm finding scattered throughout here, and what everybody will find, is Philip Melanchthon keeps saying, they hide Christ's glory. They rob consciences of firm consolation. And then further down the page again, this detracts from Christ's glory. It brings destruction to souls. It's all about the gospel. It's always all about Jesus Christ. And that's the point of the Reformation.
We only have a few short minutes here, Paul. What will we be discussing in our series with you next week on the Lutheran Confessions?
The most well-known documents in the whole Book of Concord, particularly the most well-known, the Small Catechism and the Large Catechism by Martin Luther.
Oh, good. We can take them both in one fell swoop?
I think that's our plan. I'll have to check the schedule again, but for sure we'll be covering the Small Catechism.
Before we go, tell us a little bit about Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions, this reader's edition of the Book of Concord.
Well, it was intended precisely to be this, a reader's edition that would help people who know nothing about the Book of Concord to open this rather imposing book up and to immerse themselves in the times, people, places, event, most importantly, the whole meaning of the Lutheran Reformation, and most importantly, to show how the gospel of Jesus Christ is the underlying theme that pulls all of these documents together, and it is the beating heartbeat of the Lutheran Confessions.
Folks, to find out more about Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions, a reader's edition of the Book of Concord, you can go to cph.org. That's the website address for Concordia Publishing House, cph.org, or just give them a call any weekday during regular business hours. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Paul, thank you very much for being our guest.
My pleasure, Todd. Talk to you next week.
Pastor Paul McCain, publisher and executive director of the editorial department at Concordia Publishing House based in St. Louis and general editor of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions. Well, we got an hour of issues, et cetera, straight ahead. On the other side of this break, Corey Casimir is going to be joining us to talk about yesterday's rededication, a rather elaborate and expensive Nation of Islam mosque, not an Islamic mosque, but a mosque for the Nation of Islam, headed for many years now by Louis Farrakhan. We'll find out what happened there in Chicago with Corey Casimir, author of the book Islamic Imposters, Exposing the Beliefs of Black Muslims. And then we'll round off today's program. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery will join us for the beginning of what will be a five-part daily series on answering the objections of unbelievers. Now, I don't think I'd begin with the existence of God. I don't think Dr. Montgomery would either. We'd begin with, say, the resurrection of Jesus Christ, which is probably what we're going to end up talking about in this first part of our series. But so many people's objections, be they the objections of atheists or agnostics or people of other religions besides Christianity, have to do with the existence of God. Some people will say it's just illogical to begin with God. Where did God come from? That's one of the objections we'll be answering with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. Right after this, I'm Todd Wilkin. Hour two of Issues, Etc. is straight ahead, so stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues, Etc., P.O. Box 1046, San Juan Capistrano, California, 92693. Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.